From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
I am Tahsin Hassan, husband of Margaret Hassan. I have been told that there is a video of Margaret which appears to show her murder.
Iraqi aid worker Margaret Hassan is believed to have been executed in Iraq. She was kidnapped a month ago in Baghdad. We'll speak with Dennis Halliday, the former head of the UN humanitarian program in Iraq.
The loss of Margaret Hassan is not only a great blow to Iraq and to the people of Iraq, but it closes down one of the most effective aid agencies operating in that country. It's a tragedy, unjustified, a great loss.
And as President Bush continues to reshape his cabinet in the wake of the election, three presidential candidates who ran against him are calling for recounts in Ohio and New Hampshire. Not one of them is John Kerry. We'll speak with Green Party presidential candidate David Cobb. And U.S. torture flights. We'll speak with a reporter who broke the story.
There is a network of airlines which are unmarked, and they use executive jets, and they're being used by the U.S. government to transport prisoners around the world. And the concern with this is that many of the countries that receive these prisoners are countries like Egypt, which carry out torture on a very regular basis. In fact, it's routine in the way they deal with prisoners.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Humanitarian aid worker Margaret Hassan is believed to have been executed in Iraq. A video has emerged that showed a blindfolded woman, apparently Margaret Hassan, being shot in the head. Al Jazeera obtained the tape but has decided not to air it. The 59-year-old Margaret Hassan headed the organization CARE International, which has pulled out of the country. The Irish-born British citizen had lived in Iraq for the past three decades, was well known for her critique of U.S. policy in Iraq. British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw said, quote, "It's repugnant to commit such a crime against a woman who spent most of her life working for the good of the people of Iraq." Hassan's husband yesterday begged for the return of her body. It remains unknown who kidnapped or killed Margaret Hassan. A friend of Hassan, Felicity Arbuthnot, told BBC that she had felt Hassan was doomed once the U.S. assault began on Fallujah. Independent journalist Dar Jamal is reporting Red Cross officials in Iraq are now estimating 800 Iraqi civilians have been killed during the siege of Fallujah. Jamal quotes an unnamed Red Cross official who insisted on remaining anonymous out of fear of U.S. military reprisal. The U.S. military has claimed no civilians have been killed in the city, even though the city of 300,000 has recently witnessed some of the most intense fighting of the Iraq War. The military has estimated 1,200 fighters have been killed. Meanwhile, the UN Human Rights High Commissioner yesterday called for an investigation into alleged abuses in Fallujah and elsewhere.
Well, the High Commissioner this morning called very clearly on all the parties to do all that they can to ensure that civilians are protected while the fighting is going on, and also that any alleged violations taking place in Fallujah are thoroughly investigated and that those responsible are brought to justice, be they members of the multinational force or the insurgents.
That was Jose Diaz, spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. The call came on the same day the video emerged showing a U.S. Marine shooting dead an injured unarmed Iraqi lying down in a mosque. Video of the murder has been broadcast around the world. While the military has vowed to investigate the killing, Marines interviewed by Reuters downplayed the incident, and some suggested the shooting was justified. Sergeant Nicholas Graham of Pittsburgh said, quote, "I would have shot the insurgent, too. Two shots to the head. You can't trust these people. He should not be investigated. He did nothing wrong." In other news from Iraq, over 1,000 U.S. troops are fighting in Mosul in an attempt to block the Iraqi resistance from taking complete control of the city. Los Angeles Times reported mortar attacks hit three police stations in Mosul. Several Iraqi troops and civilians were killed, and the Kurdish Party headquarters came under attack. The Washington Post quotes a U.S. military commander who claims 80% of Mosul's police force is no longer showing up for work. In Ramadi, at least 9 people have died in fighting between U.S. forces and the Iraqi resistance. Fighting was also reported in Baji, Bakuba, Barburitz, and Balad. In Iraq, U.S. forces have arrested the deputy speaker of the interim Iraqi National Council in a move that raises new questions as to the sovereignty of the Iraqi government. The arrested man, Nasir Ayef, is a leading Sunni politician who is one of the highest-ranking officials in the interim government. His arrest comes less than a week after his party, the Iraqi Islamic Party, pulled out of the Iraqi government in protest of the attack on Fallujah. The Arabic news station Al Arabiya is also reporting the U.S. military has held one of its correspondents for the past 5 days in detention. The journalist Abdelkader al-Sadi was picked up in Fallujah on Thursday. The arrest has limited how much Arabic TV networks have been able to cover the assault on Fallujah. The other main satellite station, Al Jazeera, has been officially banned from reporting in Iraq by the U.S.-backed interim Iraqi government. The so-called Coalition of the Willing is about to get one nation smaller. Hungary has announced it'll be ending its presence in Iraq by March of next year. The country's parliament rejected a proposal by the government to extend the deployment of its troops beyond March 31, 2005. In Washington, President Bush officially nominated one of his closest confidants, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, to serve as the country's next Secretary of State. Rice spoke to the media shortly after her nomination.
I look forward, with the consent of the Senate, to pursuing your hopeful and ambitious agenda as Secretary of State. Mr. President, it is an honor to be asked to serve your administration and my country once again. And it is humbling to imagine succeeding my dear friend and mentor, Colin Powell.
That was Condoleezza Rice speaking yesterday. Also on Tuesday, President Bush nominated Rice's deputy, Stephen Hadley, to become the nation's new national security advisor. This news from the CIA just days after Newsday reported the White House had ordered a purge of Bush critics within the CIA. The agency's new head, Porter Goss, has told employees that their job is, quote, to support the administration and its policies. In the memo, Goss said, quote, as agency employees, we do not identify with, support, or champion opposition to the administration or its policies. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting that thousands of employees and contractors inside the Department of Homeland Security have been forced to sign non-disclosure agreements that prohibit them from sharing sensitive but unclassified information with the public. In news from Capitol Hill, House Republicans are preparing to overturn a House rule that bars members indicted by state prosecutors to remain in leadership positions. The Washington Post reports the rule change is designed to shield Majority Leader Tom DeLay in case he's indicted in Texas. A grand jury is investigating whether Congressmember DeLay committed campaign finance violations in 2002 when he helped state Republicans gain control of the Texas State House. In September, a Texas grand jury indicted 3 political operatives with ties to DeLay, as well as 8 companies that made donations to a political action committee created with help from DeLay. In other news from the Hill, Democratic Senator Harry Reid of Nevada was elected Tuesday to replace Tom Daschle as Senate Minority Leader. And the city of Chicago opened a new surveillance command center Tuesday that will give officials the ability to remotely watch and listen to most areas of Chicago all the time. Stationed around Chicago will be 2,000 cameras and microphones that send back live feeds to command center. The city says the system is needed to deal with emergencies, but it's unclear what role it will play in policing Chicago. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we reported earlier, independent journalist Dar Jamal is reporting that Red Cross officials in Iraq are now estimating 800 Iraqi civilians have been killed during the siege on Fallujah. Dar Jamal joins us now from Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks again, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us what you have found out?
Well, as the report states, the official with the Red Cross does claim that the 800 number is the most conservative estimate they would put out to the media at this time. However, he did go on to say in that interview that this is extremely conservative, that this doesn't take into account people buried under the rubble of homes and other horrendous things that have happened there. This was a number taken solely from people coming out. This is just what they've tabulated so far from refugees coming and reporting to them and keeping track of the names and tabulating it that way. So, of course, he expects that number to be far, far higher. This is continuing to be confirmed by accounts being told by refugees that I have been interviewing who continue to stream out of Fallujah or the camps set up in the desert around the city. One man in particular reported that there were so many dead bodies on the ground, no one could bury them, and the stench was unbearable. He claimed that U.S. soldiers were dropping some of the bodies into the Euphrates River that runs right nearby Fallujah, and that other bodies were being pulled by tanks to the soccer stadium and left there. So as time drags on, as the siege drags on in Fallujah, we expect more of these type of stories to be coming out.
The official that you quote in your piece, the Red Cross, estimating 50,000 residents remain trapped in Fallujah. That is nothing like the reports we're getting from the mainstream press that makes it sound like a ghost city with some insurgents left that's basically been occupied by the U.S. military.
Right, which is the exact report that the military is giving, which is exactly why the U.S. military is reporting, or I'm sorry, the U.S. media is reporting it, because most of these reporters are embedded with the military there, and even if they did attempt to send out a more accurate picture of what's going on there, of course their reports are subject to military censorship.
Which brings up the issue of what kind of news is getting out of there. You've got embedded reporters with the U.S. military, and then the two major Arab satellite networks, Al Arabiya, the reporter detained by the U.S. military, and Al Jazeera, forbidden to report from Fallujah. Could you explain what's happening and what you know of this Al Arabiya reporter, what has happened to him?
Well, as you mentioned, he did go to Fallujah to try to get inside the city to report on what was really happening, and he was promptly detained by the military, and he is still being held. That's all the news that we have. He's essentially disappeared at this point, which is the typical case when anyone's detained here. They vanish. There is no contact with them. So he's had no one's been able to contact him, nor him anyone else. I should add also that as of yesterday, U.S.-backed Prime Minister Alawi made a statement that any Al Jazeera journalist caught trying to report in Iraq will be detained. So they remain under the gun, and the media crackdown here has really been beyond belief. They've made announcements prompting media to report, quote-unquote, accurately, meaning they only want the U.S. military side of the story. And this crackdown on the Arab media has been very pronounced, because stations like Al Jazeera have consistently done a very good job of reporting extremely accurately what is happening here on the ground in Iraq. They do very good war reporting. They do show the graphic images, as they should, because this is a war and this is what's happening here. And this is why they continue to catch so much flack from the United States, and particularly Defense Minister Rumsfeld. This is why their office in Baghdad was bombed during the initial invasion of Iraq, even though they specifically gave their coordinates to the Pentagon to avoid that happening. So it keeps continuing on into the occupation. And, of course, when the fighting rages and reports come out that don't play in the best interests of the U.S. military here or the U.S. government, of course, the hammer gets dropped once again on the media that's doing their job.
Last question about the U.S. forces also arresting the deputy speaker of the interim Iraqi National Council, a move that is raising questions about the sovereignty of the Iraqi government. Nasir Ayef, a leading Sunni politician, one of the highest ranking in the interim government, coming after a week after the Iraqi Islamic Party, his party, pulled out of the Iraqi government protesting the attack on Fallujah.
Right, and this also followed the fact that another leader of the Islamic Party, Ayad Arif, was also detained, and also just the other day down in Karbala, a prominent Shiite Ayatollah there, Hassan al-Sarki, also had his office raided because he had called to boycott the election because he did not feel the interim government was going to hold them fairly. So the crackdown continues almost on a daily basis now. We have an official from some party or some religious sect that is being detained. People, when these offices are raided, in fact, the individual I just mentioned, Hassan al-Sarki, when his office was raided, two of his followers were killed before he was actually detained himself. So the crackdown on the media here, as well as the so-called democracy and being able to have some sort of elections with parties that people do want to represent them, it's just not happening. And quite the contrary, this is looking more and more like the regime of Saddam Hussein by the day. It's really an astounding thing to watch.
Dar Jamal reporting to us from Iraq, unembedded independent journalist. He publishes his reports in a blog called darjamaliraq.com, and you can also link to it through our website at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to the videotape that Al Jazeera has gotten that they have not aired, that it is claimed is showing a blindfolded woman, apparently Margaret Hassan, being shot in the head. A friend of Margaret Hassan, Felicity Arbuthnot, told BBC she'd felt Hassan was doomed once the U.S. assault began on Fallujah. Yes, a statement from Margaret Hassan's family in London said they believe she's dead. Her four brothers and sisters' statement was released by Britain's Foreign Office. It reads, quote, "Our hearts are broken. We have kept hoping for as long as we could, but we now have to accept that Margaret has probably gone and at last her suffering has ended." The statement went on to say, quote, "Nobody can justify this. Margaret was against sanctions and the war. To commit such a crime against anyone is unforgivable, but we cannot believe how anybody could do this to our kind, compassionate sister. The gap she leaves will never be filled," they said. Margaret Hassan was 59 years old. She was head of the Baghdad operations of the British charity Care International. She held British, Irish, and Iraqi nationality, was married to an Iraqi man, had converted to Islam. She lived in Iraq for 30 years, dedicating her life to addressing the many humanitarian catastrophes in that country. On October 19th, she was kidnapped by armed men on her way to work in western Baghdad early in the morning. Videos of Margaret Hassan in captivity were released over the last few weeks, but no group had claimed responsibility for her abduction. In two of the videos, Margaret Hassan pleaded for her life and asked Tony Blair to withdraw British troops out of Iraq. When we come back from our break, we will speak with Dennis Halliday, who is a colleague of Margaret Hassan, also originally from Ireland. He is the assistant UN, the UN Secretary General in Iraq, and joins us today in our studio. We'll be back in a minute. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, Pacifica and NPR stations, public access TV, PBS stations, as well as both satellite networks on Dish Networks, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375 Link TV. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to talk about Margaret Hassan, again, videotapes over the last few weeks of Margaret Hassan were released, were aired on Al Jazeera as Margaret Hassan pleaded for her life and pleaded with Tony Blair to withdraw the British troops from Iraq.
Please, please help me. Please help me. This might be my last hours. Please help me. Please, the British people, ask Mr. Blair to take the troops out of Iraq. And not to bring them here to Baghdad. That's why people like Mr. Bigley and myself are being caught. And maybe we will die. I will die like Mr. Bigley. Please, 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 the British people, please help me.
Margaret Hassan pleading for her life on videotape. Relatives also pleaded with the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, and the British government to meet the kidnappers' demands. One of her sisters, Deirdre Fitzsimmons, said, quote, "We are Irish. We have no influence on the British government." Yesterday, Al Jazeera announced it had received a tape showing a blindfolded woman being shot in the head, believed to be Margaret Hassan. An Al Jazeera spokesperson said the station was holding off airing it until it was convinced that the woman was Margaret. Yesterday, Margaret Hassan's husband, Tahsin, appealed to the kidnappers to tell him the whereabouts of his wife's body.
I am Tahsin Hassan, husband of Margaret Hassan. I have been told that there is a video of Margaret which appears to show her murder. The video may be genuine, but I do not know. I beg those people who took Margaret to tell me what they have done with her. They can't tell me. They can't call the helpline. I need her. I need her back to rest in peace. Margaret lived with me in Iraq for 30 years. She dedicated her life to serving the Iraqi people. Please now, please return her to me.
Margaret Hassan's husband, Tahsin. If her death is confirmed, she will be the first foreign female hostage to have been murdered in Iraq. Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk of the London Independent, who's met Hassan several times, writes, quote, "If Margaret Hassan can be kidnapped and murdered, how much further can we fall into the Iraqi pit? There are no barriers, no frontiers of immorality left. What price is innocence now worth in the anarchy that we have brought to Iraq? The answer is simple, nothing." Dennis Halliday joins us in our studio. He's the former head of the UN humanitarian program in Iraq and a former UN assistant secretary general. In 1998, he resigned his post in protest of the U.S.-led sanctions against Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Your thoughts. You, too, like Margaret Hassan, are an Irish citizen.
Mm. Well, sad to say, we Irish are now collaborators with the Bush aggression, the Bush invasion, the Bush regime. And we have supported Bush and his warplanes going through Shannon Airport. So we're going to have to stand up and be counted as amongst the weak who went along with the Bush act of aggression vis-a-vis Iraq. However, Margaret, you know, was an extraordinary person who was an Iraqi, in effect, dedicated her life. It's an extraordinary, horrific phenomenon that she's been killed. It just is incomprehensible.
When did you know Margaret?
Well, I worked with her in 97 and 98 in Iraq, in Baghdad. I lived there that's where she and her family lived. She ran a small CARE international program, some $7 million worth per annum, and she produced hands-on results, clinics, health facilities, water systems, which the poor of Baghdad and other cities needed desperately. I was there overseeing a $4 billion program, and prohibited from doing the same sort of hands-on work by Washington and the London and Washington regimes. So I have nothing but respect for her work and for her commitment and her gentle nature, although underlined with steel. She's a quality that she delivered. She made things happen.
What did it mean to work under the sanctions in Iraq? What exactly was she doing?
Well, she was literally finding money from overseas to put into the reconstruction and rebuilding of health clinics for women and children in particular, and she focused on water supplies. As you may know, the Pentagon decision to destroy water systems in Iraq deliberately to kill Iraqi children was indeed successful, and the great loss of life during the sanctions period after the Gulf War was directly due to the Pentagon decision to do that. Margaret was one of those working against that crime, that war crime, and restoring water systems, potable water systems, to the cities, poor areas of most cities in Iraq.
The great deal of international attention that the Simonas, the two Italian women and their Iraqi colleagues, right, a woman and a man, got, many feel, helped to free them. It may also well have been a good deal of money from the Italian government. What do you think happened with Margaret Hassan in terms of negotiations? Were contacts made, Irish government, British government?
Yes, it's so easy with hindsight, I suppose, to be critical. I always felt that it was a mistake for the Irish government to stand up and call for her release, and even worse, for Tony Blair, a man who is also guilty of war crimes, and part of the act of aggression against Iraq, the supporter of Bush and the invasion. This is, in one hand, what they wanted to hear, but these are the wrong people. There's no respect for Bush or Blair in Iraq, and the people who are holding Margaret Hassan, who are not Iraqis, I believe, but probably those from outside the country. You know, they've no desire to respond to the requests of a man like Bush or Blair. So this was a non-starter. I think Felicity Arbuthnot is correct. Once the Fallujah invasion began, I think the life of Margaret was lost.
You were recently in Ireland on the witness stand defending someone who was protesting the war. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we have a woman called Mary Kelly who climbed over the fence at Shannon Airport and took an axe and attacked a U.S. warplane en route to the Mediterranean, providing support to the war in Iraq. The government, under, I think, a pressure from the Washington regime of Mr. Bush, has been prosecuting her. We've now had three trials. The first was didn't go through. The second we had to do again. The third one, Ramsey Clark, Daniel Ellsberg, and myself flew in from New York. And ultimately were disallowed. Our witness in defense of Mary Kelly and her action, which in my view is in keeping with the Nuremberg principles of standing up and taking on a minor act of violence to prevent a much greater act of violence, such as the murder of what we now understand is well over 100,000 Iraqi civilians, was not allowed within the Irish criminal court system. So we were dismissed, and the jury has now found her guilty, and she's waiting sentencing. I think there'll be a retrial, there'll be an appeal, another retrial. But it's an example of how the Irish, I think, have now become alienated to Washington, which is extraordinary given the relations between Ireland and the United States, and that this sort of action is what we all should be about. Standing up and taking action to prevent this, so that the war crime, the great war crime of aggression that Mr. Bush has undertaken.
What about what's happening in Fallujah? Your response as the former UN Assistant Secretary General, having spent a good deal of time in Iraq, your response to what's happening in Fallujah and also to the U.S. election?
Well, I know Fallujah quite well. It's a city I used to pass through when I went to Habaniya, the old RAF station, to pick up supplies from the UN aircraft. I stopped there for my afternoon tea, an old tea house serving this wonderfully lemon tea, which is unique perhaps to Iraq. It's sad to see that it's now been destroyed by the United States and that the people have suffered. And we're now hearing what 800, maybe many more, civilians have been murdered by American troops in Fallujah. I fail to understand the rationale for taking on this particular battle, along with all the other battles against the Iraqi people. I mean, to think that this is an insurgency. This is a national survival movement of the Iraqi people. And if the United States is talking about hearts and minds, I think we've heard that phrase from the Vietnam debacle, this is madness. And I think the result of Fallujah simply is that now another million Iraqis will stand up and fight for their country against the invasion and occupation by the United States. It's a game plan that I fail to understand. And the only solution, I think, is the closing down of the occupation and give this country back to the people who belong there, that is, the Iraqi people.
As you watch the campaign in the United States, did you feel at the end that, or at any point, John Kerry had proposed an alternative to President Bush's military occupation?
No, sad to say, I think John Kerry pushed, and hoping for election, was into preemptive strikes. He was into taking aggression against anybody who remotely threatened the United States. And we know perfectly well that Saddam Hussein in Iraq never threatened the United States. That is absolute propaganda and nonsense. I was very disappointed in Kerry. I think he was going to bring almost nothing new. Of course, it couldn't be worse than Bush. It might have been better, but I didn't see anything really positive from the dialogue that I saw on television here.
I wanted to ask you about a scandal that's getting attention in the U.S. media. For several months now, the U.N. has been facing widespread charges of bribery and corruption in the Oil for Food program administered in Iraq from 96 to 2003. You were head of the Oil for Food program for a few of those years. The sustained attacks against the U.N. have come from both U.S. politicians, conservative newspapers, and they're accusing Kofi Annan of a cover-up. Can you explain this Oil for Food program and then talk about your response to it? Can you explain the scandal?
Yes, Oil for Food was established in the mid-1990s, 1996, 97 in particular, under pressure from the world at large on the Security Council, particularly Washington and London, who drove the sanctions regime of the United Nations, to provide a means for the Iraqi people to have access to foodstuffs, pharmaceuticals, and some basic equipment for education, the healthcare sector, agricultural sector. The government in Baghdad was allowed to sell a certain amount of oil, initially $4 billion gross per year, and that money was then used for sending out invitations, international bidding on foodstuffs, particularly pharmaceuticals. Those contracts were then approved or not approved by the Security Council in New York, and the goods were delivered, the payments were made by the United Nations. No money went into the hands of the Iraqi people. The fact is, however, under sanctions is a form of warfare. Any opportunity the Iraqis had to find hard currency, they naturally sought and obviously accomplished. Now, there was the scandal, quote-unquote, is, in my view, nonsense. The United States was perfectly well aware of the trade between Turkey and Iraq under sanctions. They knew that Baghdad was exporting paraffin, gasoline, and oil into Turkey. This was monitored by U.S. satellites. It was agreed upon with Turkey because Turkey's an ally, a friendly NATO member, and so on. And this was compensation to Turkey for the loss of revenue given the sanctions on Iraq, its close trading neighbor and partner. There is no scandal. Everything that has happened has been monitored by the United States and Britain. The contracts were approved by the United States and Britain. The kickbacks made by companies who provided supplies, in my view, were also known. And likewise, when it came to the sale of oil by Iraq, including some 40% going to American companies indirectly, including Chevron, Miss Rice at one stage, they also paid those kickbacks indirectly and certainly in full knowledge of what they were doing. As you know, during the sanctions period, some 9 or 10% of the oil coming into the United States was Iraqi oil. So there is no scandal. Washington has been fully informed. I think as Carl Levan has said, mentioned in the New York Times today or yesterday, we knew what was going on. I knew what was going on. We knew that there was smuggling and trade going on outside sanctions, and we knew perfectly well that Washington had approved this trade.
So why now? Why is this coming out now?
I think it's because the UN has become irritating, but the Secretary General finally has woken up to his responsibility and has announced that the war is illegal, which has sort of threatened, I think, the United States and Britain, perhaps. And the old frustration of the neocon right wing who feels the UN is a threat, international law is unacceptable. It's part of the rejection by the Bush regime of Kyoto, of the ICC, of all the other international laws which the rest of us in the world feel are so important, but are rejected by Congress as they, because they feel it impinges on the Constitution and their function and so on.
When Charles Delfer addressed the Congressional subcommittee, he singled out a former UN official, Benin Sevan, as a recipient of some 13 million barrels of oil from Saddam Hussein. Now, Sevan has denied the charges. He was your boss in Iraq?
No, I worked directly for the Secretary General, but he became the boss of von Sponeck a few years after my period in Baghdad.
And what do you believe? Do you believe that denials?
I believe Mr. Sevan is innocent until proven guilty. I think the point to make, however, is that we put together $64 billion from Iraqi oil sales, gross. The UN took off 35%. They gave 30% to Kuwait while Iraqi children were dying for lack of water and adequate foodstuffs. And that's a crime in itself, in my view. And many of us believe sanctions, in fact, turned out to be genocidal. But the Oil for Food program did extraordinarily good work. We fed over 20 million Iraqis every day for many years. We saved, I would think, hundreds of thousands of lives. This so-called scandal is a fiction, in my view. Now, if some members of the Secretariat broke the rules, they must be prosecuted like any other normal human being. I don't believe the Secretariat is the problem. The problem is the United Nations and its member states, particularly Washington and London, who make the decisions, who design the sanctions, who design the Gulf War and the most recent invasion. These are the people who make the decisions that impact on Iraq. They are the ones who knew what was happening. They allowed the Baghdad government to have hard currency from Jordan and Turkey and other smuggling arrangements and kickbacks. They know all about this. It's nonsense to put the finger on Kofi Annan or the Secretariat.
Do you think so? Kofi Annan should open all the documents, just make the UN transparent on this?
Absolutely. I can't understand why he's holding back information. They should open the doors, open the files. People like von Sponeck and myself and others should be made available to Volcker and to those in Washington who are concerned. I think we can show there's a different light here. This is not a complex issue. This is a known private sector quantity approved by Washington.
Have you asked the Secretary General to make you available?
He knows I'm available. He knows I'm in New York, and I'm waiting to be called by Volcker and Washington. And Hans, who was on this your show recently, feels the same way as I do.
Dennis Halliday, I want to thank you very much for joining us. A former assistant UN Secretary General, headed the Oil for Food program in Iraq in the late 90s, quit over the sanctions regime. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to a presidential candidate who's calling for a recount in Ohio. And no, he's not John Kerry. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush nominated Condoleezza Rice yesterday as he continues to reshape his cabinet for his second four-year term. But controversy continues to rage over the fairness and accuracy of the November 2nd presidential election. Stories are still emerging from states like Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, and New Mexico of widespread problems with vote counting, voter suppression, and malfunctions of electronic voting machines. Now three candidates in the 2004 presidential race are demanding recounts. Not one of them is John Kerry. In New Hampshire, independent candidate Ralph Nader is asking for a recount to test the accuracy of optical scan vote counting machines. The request covers 11 of the state's 126 precincts that use Diebold Inc.'s AccuVote optical scanning machines to count paper ballots. Backers urge Nader to request a recount after a statistical analysis posted on the internet appeared to show that some New Hampshire precincts using the machines gave President Bush up to 15% more votes than had been expected on the basis of the exit polls and the 2000 presidential vote. Meanwhile, the Green and Libertarian parties announced they've raised $150,000 over the past week, enough to file the required fee for a statewide recount of the vote in Ohio. While they scramble to raise the required $150,000 in time to file the recount request. Democratic candidate John Kerry has been sitting on over $50 million in unspent campaign funds. According to the Center for Public Integrity, Kerry could use that money to fund recount efforts. We're joined right now by David Cobb, lawyer from Texas, now lives in California, Green Party presidential candidate in this election. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, David Cobb.
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be back.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what you're calling for in Ohio?
Well, Amy, we will be demanding a full statewide recount of every ballot cast that we can get our hands on in the state of Ohio. And I want to stop for a moment, back up, and really give some context to this story, because corporate media is attempting to manufacture consent around the lie that this was a clean and fair election. The reality is this was not a clean and fair election. Far from it. There is a litany of problems, not only the problems that you mentioned in terms of the voting equipment themselves, but the clear and obvious civil rights and voting rights violations that occurred in this election. And I just want to observe that it was only thanks to Pacifica and community radio across this country that this story was really getting out, and the internet and ordinary citizens telling each other the stories that they were hearing. Corporate media manufacturing consent around a lie, the people's radio, Pacifica community radio stations telling the truth. I think that's a profound background and backdrop that we should remember as we go through with this story.
So what exactly will happen? You've got the $150,000. What will happen now?
Well, we're not allowed under law to actually demand the recount until the Republican Secretary of State, Blackwell, actually officially certifies the results. He has not done so. They're still counting, that we know of, over 153,000 provisional ballots. That high number of provisional ballots is actually part of the problem, by the way, where only he and his office has the final say on how and where and under what circumstances those ballots will be counted. But as soon as that certification takes place, we will be demanding and filing in every single county in the state of Ohio for a full recount. Under Ohio state law, they must certify the results by December 3rd, but they might do it earlier. So we're prepared immediately to file that recount.
The New York Times moved very quickly in and did a whole piece basically debunking any questions about the vote and said there's a lot of blogs and internet swirls that are alleging some kind of fraud or miscount, but that, you know, it's got to be put to rest pretty fast.
Well, again, the corporate media doing its job to try to manufacture consent. But the reality, what we know on the ground from citizens on the ground, in fact, providing testimony at citizen-conducted hearings, public hearings, we know for a fact that there were screens which had a, quote, jumping screen problem, that is, where folks attempted to cast a ballot for one presidential candidate and the screen literally jumped in the attempt to default a vote for Bush. We know, of course, the infamous precinct now where less than 700 people voted, yet the machines attempted to record 4,000 extra votes for Bush. Of course, the intolerably long lines in low-income communities, especially communities of color, African-American communities, which is a function of the allocation of voting machines, decisions made by a Republican Secretary of State where too few machines went into African-American communities. We know that there are over 92,000 ballots that are literally being discarded, or the so-called spoiled ballots, where there was an alleged overvote or undervote. It's the hanging Chad problem all over again, where we're demanding that those votes need to be looked at to determine whether there was an intent to actually cast a ballot or not. these provisional ballots and the high number of them are really problematic because so many were cast because longtime voters simply disappeared from the voter rolls. We don't know why. There was an illegal use of ID requirements for voters that were illegal under Ohio law. This is just the tip of the iceberg, Amy. We haven't even touched upon the inherent problems with black box voting. I'm talking about reports on the ground flooding in by the thousands of people in Ohio who experienced voting rights violations as they attempted to exercise their right to vote. So I don't know if this recount is going to result in changing the election results. Frankly, that's not my intent. My intent is to attempt to do two things, really, to raise a cloud over the legitimacy of this election and George Bush. We know that Bush stole the election in 2000. So I want to just at least raise this point. And the second thing I want to do is to have a healthy discussion and create the political space necessary for that discussion to describe the systemic changes that are necessary so that we, the people, can have confidence in the legitimacy of our elections.
We're talking to David Cobb, Green Party presidential candidate for 2004. I wanted to know if you've talked to the Democratic Party about what they're doing with their money. Looking at the report from the Center for Public Integrity, they did a day before the election. John Kerry has $51 million left. That is more than any presidential candidate ever had. He has, I think George Bush had something around $25 million. So he has about $27 million. He has about $17 million more than George Bush. Compare $51 million to what Gore had after 2000. He had something like $3 million. Center for Public Integrity asked the Kerry campaign what they were going to do with this money. They refused to say. But have you been in communication with them? Have they talked about putting some of this money into recount efforts?
No, we haven't had the formal conversation with the Kerry campaign. Frankly, Amy, we've been too busy putting our grassroots effort together on the fly. We did not expect, frankly, in the Green Party to be the only party, well, with our friends in the Libertarian Party, we didn't expect to be in the process of having to demand the recount if these allegations had come through. So we're putting together our team on the fly to stand up for the rights of Americans to demand the recount. So we do know that the $50 million is available. We do know that it would be available for recounts, but so far there's been a deafening silence on the part of the Kerry campaign. And I do want to make a distinction here between the leadership of the Democratic Party and the rank and file members of the Democratic Party. The rank and file members of the Democratic Party on this issue seem to be howling with indignation, and we're getting words of support and emails and letters of encouragement. And I'm not surprised, because the rank and file members of the Democratic Party are infinitely more progressive than the leadership of the Democratic Party or of John Kerry.
Do you think that John Kerry simply doesn't want to look like a sore loser and is looking to 2008 and could possibly use these funds towards that?
You know, Amy, that conclusion certainly does not escape me. But I don't know why John Kerry is so silent, but he is complicit in his silence. And he is certainly complicit in a concession speech, which was a downright capitulation, especially in light of all of the evidence that was already available about voting rights violations that occurred in Ohio. Many people, in fact, everybody who was associated with the campaign in Ohio on the night of the election was absolutely convinced that there would be at least a recount and probable litigation. So we were stunned the next day when Kerry conceded. Why he did so, you know, is speculation that we can all do. If it's true that he conceded and then tried to basically brush aside all the voting rights violations in some effort to position himself for 2008, I think that is a profound mistake, and even more than simply a strategic mistake, I think it's shameful. About as shameful as what's happening in Fallujah, by the way.
David Cobb, are you calling for John Kerry to unconcede?
Listen, I think I don't want John Kerry to be in the White House. I'd like to be in the White House. I think that the people deserve a peace candidate in the White House. The people of the United States deserve a candidate calling for universal health care and a living wage and end to the prison industrial complex. But the reality is, Amy, it's obvious I did not win the White House. I'm calling for whoever won the presidential election to be in the White House. We don't know who that is at this point. It stuns me that John Kerry is silent, but I'm proud that the Green Party is standing up.
David Cobb, I want to thank you for being with us again, the Green Party presidential candidate, together with the Libertarian Party presidential candidate, Michael Badnarik, are calling for a recount of the votes in Ohio. Ralph Nader for a recount of the votes in Ohio.
Thank you, Amy. And if I could, if for listeners, if you want to get involved either as a donor or as a volunteer on the recount effort, please go to our website, votecobb.org.
Thanks very much for being with us again.
My
David
pleasure.
Cobb calling for that recount in Ohio, Nader calling for it in New Hampshire. As we wrap up with this final story, the Sunday Times of London has obtained evidence the U.S. government is leasing a special Gulfstream jet to transport detained suspects to other countries that routinely use torture in their prisons. Logs for the airplane show the Pentagon and CIA have used the plane more than 300 times and dropped off detainees in Syria, Egypt, and Uzbekistan. The Gulfstream and a similarly anonymous-looking Boeing 737 are hired by American agents from Premier Executive Transport Services, a private company in Massachusetts. Analysis of the plane's flight plans covering more than 2 years shows it always departs from Washington, D.C. It's flown to a total of 49 destinations outside the United States, including Guantanamo Bay prison camp in Cuba and other military bases, as well as Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Morocco, Afghanistan, Libya, and Uzbekistan. Witnesses have claimed that the suspects are frequently bound, gagged, sedated before being put on the flights, which don't have special facilities for prisoners, but are kitted out with tables for meetings and screens for presentations and in-flight films. The U.S. plane is not used just for carrying prisoners, but also appears to be at the disposal of military and intelligence officials on assignment from Washington. We're joined by Stephen Gray, who's a journalist with the Sunday Times, who exposed the story this week, how the U.S. is operating these secret flights. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi.
Can you tell us further about these flights, who the people are, and how you found out about them?
Well, first of all, it remains something of a mystery, this whole story. But obviously, bit by bit, the whole this kind of secret world is unraveling, and we're getting more and more information about the individual cases where these planes are being used. And what it exposes is the tentacles of a wider system whereby prisoners are being taken in the war on terror, not only to Guantanamo, but to many other places. And those places include the prisons of so-called allies of the U.S. and Britain around the world. And those countries which are allies of the U.S. include countries where torture is routine. And obviously, the concerns that many people have are that these kind of transfers basically allow the U.S. to pass prisoners into the hands of the secret police of other countries to do the kind of interrogation, torture, in fact, of prisoners that U.S. is not allowed to do itself. It's kind of torture by proxy.
The company. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the company is not that important in a sense. These are private planes, and they're being leased. They're not marked. I mean, that's the point about them, is that they can appear anywhere. And you have, innocent-looking, if you like, executive jets parked on the runways of airports around the world. No one's to know they're actually planes run by the U.S. military and intelligence services. So they have the perfect cover, if you like. But it's what's happening is that, and they're hired from a company that operates in in Massachusetts and others. But you know, they're probably just a normal private company. What they're doing is leasing it out. They only work for the government. As I say, the plane is not just used for carrying prisoners. It's also used for transferring of, you know, interrogators and also regular VIP defense and intelligence officials from Washington. But what we found is at least four cases which have emerged where this plane has been seen actually picking up prisoners. And in the first case, which we discovered, the two prisoners were taken from Sweden to Egypt. And at the time, this has happened just after September 11th, and it's been going on since. But in this case, just after September 11th, two prisoners were taken on board. The Swedish government never mentioned the U.S. at the time. They said they were just extraditing two prisoners. But what actually happened was that the U.S. was there with this secret plane. They stripped these men of their clothes, handcuffed them, put them in diapers, gave them sedatives against their will, put them on the plane, and took them to Egypt. And since then, we've discovered these prisoners complained of being very seriously tortured with electric shocks all over their bodies, you know, as a result of being taken to Egypt. And that's the consequence of this kind of process, which we know as rendition.
Stephen Gray, I want to thank you for being with us in the Sunday Times of London, exposing the U.S. torture flights. This is Democracy Now! As we wrap up the program, Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Ryan Abernathy, and Mike DeFilippo are our engineers. I'll be in Pittsburgh tomorrow, 4:30 at Carnegie Mellon, and 6 and 7 at the Thomas Merton Center. On Friday, we leave for Spain. We'll be broadcasting from Madrid on Monday and Tuesday, and from Rome, Italy, on Wednesday. For those who listen or watch on the internet at democracynow.org from Italy and Spain, please email us, and we'll give you further details at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. As the president, as the Queen and King of Spain, will be meeting with President Bush in Crawford, Texas. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.